Great to be with you on this Friday, the 3rd of October. I'd like to begin firstly by acknowledging the First Nations of the land where we're broadcasting from and also around the country. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders and non-Indigenous elders who might be listening to us today on 98.9 FM, on the National Indigenous Radio Service or live on our web streaming. Great to have you along. Look, I have with me today two human rights campaigners, Rodney Dillon and Tammy Solnick from Amnesty International, to share with us a few areas of concern regarding Aboriginal homelands and also to talk a bit about the work that they're doing here in our part of the world in southeast Queensland. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Firstly, I'll go to you, Rodney, if I could. Tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, I'm from northeast Tasmania, Palawa people in Tasmania. So, yeah, our family's been there for thousands of generations.
And of course, I remember you from your days with ATSIC as an ATSIC commissioner. You're now with Amnesty International. What's your role with them?
I'm an Aboriginal advisor to Amnesty, and we're doing a lot of different projects at the moment. So it's good. It's probably we're quite busy, so it's a good job.
And I understand you received a gong from Amnesty International, or was it from in Tasmania that you received the Human Rights
Award? Yeah, last year. Yeah.
So congratulations on that one, belatedly somewhat.
Yeah.
But
no, that's good to get things like that sometimes. So I think to see the work that we do in remote communities is more important than receiving things, but sometimes to look back, they're good things sometimes to pick up as you go through. Mm.
And, I mean, it's been some time since ATSIC's no longer been in existence. I mean, is the work very different from what you used to do?
No, probably not. It's similar sort of work, but the only difference I find working for Amnesty is that we've got a lot of supporters. A lot of the wider community supporters that back us as an organisation. So I see that our organisation is strong in, you know, having that support of campaigning to the government and stuff like that. So as an organisation, I think it's quite good that we can do that.
Mm, right. Tammy, welcome to Let's Talk. You're no stranger to this program. Neither is Rodney. Rodney's been on here yarning to Tiger a few times before. And Tammy, I think the first time that you might have been on here was when you were involved, well, you still are involved with the Congress.
Yes, I'm still a board member of the National Congress.
Yep. All right. Well, firstly, tell us a bit about yourself. You're from Western Australia, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm a Ningana woman from Derby in the Kimberley. I grew up mainly in the Pilbara, and I've lived in Perth for over 20 years working alongside Noongar people. So Western Australian, born and bred, and really proud to be Western Australian.
And you're a lawyer.
I'm a lawyer by trade. I'm not practising at the moment, but I did my articles and restricted practice at the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia.
Right. Why did you decide on a career in law?
I was actually quite fortunate when I was 17 to be in the inaugural Aboriginal pre-law program for all of Australia at UWA. It worked for me. I was good at it straight away and I enjoyed it, and I really haven't looked back since there. So I've been involved in law since I was 17.
Wow, fantastic. And it's great to hear from people like yourself. I don't know how you feel, whether you feel comfortable about it, but being seen as a role model to younger Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, you know, people.
It is a bit of an uncomfortable label to have, but we need Aboriginal lawyers. There's a really big demand for it. So if I can inspire other Aboriginal people to get involved in the study of law, then that's a good thing.
Mm, all right. Well, look, we are here talking about Amnesty International business, and one of the things, I guess, that's been of concern is the demolition of the community of, the former community, Umbulgari, up in the Kimberley there. Can you just bring us up to speed with basically what happened there? Because it was 2011 that the people were forced out?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a former community because they're still a community, you know. So they're still the Umbulgari people. We have done a field trip there recently, and we worked closely with our international secretariat to determine that there had been a forced eviction in 2011. A number of people left prior to the actual forced eviction. There was only a handful, about 10 people left that we believe were forcibly evicted. Mm. But there were a lot that were indirectly made to leave prior to that through closure of services, and the community was quite unsafe for a variety of reasons. So in 2011, the government made the decision to close everything and then forcibly remove the remaining residents. And since then, they've had a really hard time. Originally, they were moved into dongas, three families per donga. So very terrible conditions. They're all pushed in one spot, and they're in those dongas for about 18 months. Mm. A lot of them have been rehoused now, but many still are not suitably housed. And the conditions in Wyndham, many of them have told us that they're worse than Umbulgari.
Yeah.
Most children aren't attending school. There's very limited liquor restrictions. For example, you can get 2 full-strength cartons of beer and 6 bottles of wine takeaway from the liquor shop in Wyndham. There's policing issues. There's lots of issues. In fact, the last man to leave, Umbulgari, that was forced to leave, bless his soul, passed away. He committed suicide in the house that they put him into in Wyndham. It has been so traumatic and devastating for the people.
Mm. And at this stage, the state government has organised contractors to go in there to demolish the houses that are standing there. How many houses are we talking about there?
About 40 houses. Mm. They're going to destroy.
Yeah.
And 40 good quality houses. And they're houses that Aboriginal people need to be housed in. We've got homeless people, mm. and yet we're destroying good houses.
Yeah, because that's what's happened, isn't it, that the people that were there originally have gone to Wyndham. What are the other communities that they've been displaced to?
All around the Kimberley, yeah. There's mm. Wyndham, Kununurra. A lot of them have gone to Collumberoo, people have mm. gone to Derby. Like when it first happened, a lot of them just started camping on the marsh. They're people that went into Kununurra and went camping on the football ground.
Mm.
They made this snap decision and they didn't develop an integration strategy. They just pushed them all out. Mm.
And we're talking about the state government here. It's not the feds.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. It's a sad story that people have been forcibly evicted from their homes and left in places where they're not meant to be. And some of the places where some of those people are, they're not secure either. And they don't feel secure. The people told us, was there talking to people, we had a meeting there on the Sunday in the park with the people, and they was very sad, and they were still upset that they wasn't settled. So the Western Australian government done a very poor job of resettling those people.
Well, one of the reasons that they closed the community down was for a number of social issues, and health issues. So I just wonder whether those social and health issues have actually exacerbated. You talked about that, a leader of that community who's committed suicide.
Yes.
As a result of, as a consequence of being removed from his traditional land. So do we know about that side of things, the impact that that's had on the people?
Yeah, they're all traumatised. A lot of them have turned to alcohol a lot more than they were. A lot of them lost jobs and haven't got proper jobs since. They're really stigmatised. They're not just stigmatised within Wyndham or within the Kimberley. They're stigmatised all over. They've all been wiped with the same brush, like they're all pedophiles.
Mm.
But they're not. We've spoken to beautiful elders. In fact, on the last day we were there, they just kept rolling all the elders out from the old people's home to come speak to us. There were more people to speak to us than we had time for. And no one had sat down and talked to them before. No one had taken their stories. It's a really sad situation.
Right. So what can Amnesty actually do about it then? I know that there's been some trying to stop it with an injunction. Yeah. How's that been going so far?
Yeah, look, the other things, we've sent about 18,000 emails to the minister.
We're nearly at 19,000.
19,000.
Yeah.
Asking the minister to stop doing that, to stop destroying this community. At the end of the day, these are people's houses, and it's where they lived and it's where they grew up. And if every average Australian was picked up and moved like these people have, and not all these peoples have done anything wrong. There's a few people that done things wrong, and those issues needed addressing. And, and we certainly condemn those things that happened, but not everyone's guilty. And yet we've had very few leaders, Aboriginal leaders around Australia, stand up to support this community. And I feel sad that our leaders have not only let these people down. But, you know, how many more people are going to be moved off their communities, and how many more people are not going to say anything? They're the sad things I see, that we as an Aboriginal community of Australia are letting our own people down by not saying nothing. And they've badged it up that all these people are pedophiles and alcoholics. Well, not all of them are, you know. A lot of these people that lived in this community was very good people. They hunted, they gathered, just like their ancestors did for thousands of generations, and yet they've been moved off that land. And you know, and they didn't have a say in that. And that's what's wrong about what's happened there. These families, these kids will never grow up with that understanding of their stories of their families from that area.
Mm. And the push came from the closure of the medical service out there. Is that correct?
Well, they started to close down all the services.
Okay.
Like, one of the first things that people have told us is that they started refusing to process their Centrelink payments, so people didn't have any money. They closed the shop, they closed the school, they closed the medical centre. Anyone that was sick had to leave. They closed the clinic. And then they switched the power and the water off. That was the last straw.
Mm.
So, you know, you really can't leave without water.
Well, yes. Well, in Northern Territory, I mean, they start with switching off the water. I mean, if we want to talk about Whitewater and what's happening there, have Amnesty been following that particular...
Yeah, so there's two. There's Utopia and Whitegate.
Okay.
Whitegate,
sorry.
Yeah. So, no, we have been following it because we've actually done a whole heap of work in Utopia.
Yeah. I want to talk about that because you did do a study about the homelands and, you know, how important it is to Aboriginal people. So maybe we'll talk about those issues and then basically why people need to be on their homeland, on country.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think the importance of the work that we've done, you know, we work with a lot of people at Utopia and a lot of the different boers around Utopia as well. We gathered information, we took people down, we took people down to Canberra to speak to the politicians, saying this is what these people are saying has happened to them. This is not Amnesty saying it. Listen to the people that's been affected. And, you know, that work that we've done was, you know, very good work, and I think that, you know, when the Labor government put that $240 million over 10 years back into remote communities, it was a very significant thing, because those old people, they knew they was going to live their life out on their homelands. Those old people didn't want to come off their homelands. They didn't care about how bad the housing was. Their most important thing, well, they did care about it, but their most important thing and they're scared of was being moved off their homelands, not unlike the people from Umbulgari. The old people wanted to stay in their community where they felt they, you know, belonged and have done for, you know, for thousands of generations. And there's not only upset about being going to be moved, but all their stories and their song lines and all their culture and, you know, their sacred objects and things like that. You know, they were concerned what was happening to them. And the work that we done on homelands was, very significant work.
Does this signal to you that, well, obviously we've got Abbott in power now, and although he does have, you know, remote Australia close to his heart, you know, if we're to looking at all the press coverage that he's received from his visit up to the Northern Territory and in remote Aboriginal communities, that that surely he would be supportive of outstations. But I think it seems to be the states that are doing that kind of work, moving people off homelands.
It seems to be the state saying that we can't afford to keep Aboriginal people on their homelands. We seem to be able to do other things in that country, but we can't keep the Aboriginal people on their homelands. And this is really at a pressure point in Australia's history now of moving people away from their lands, you know. And you know, when you take away people's lands, you take away their language, you take away their culture. It's the quickest way of destroying people. And then we get upset because they're stuck down at the bottle shop. Well, if you take all those things off people, they haven't got many things left, and that's one of the few things they'll have left, and that's one of the few social things that will, you know, will occur when you do that. You can't take people away from their lands. I mean, European people are used to being picked up and taken to other places. Aboriginal people are not. Aboriginal people have lived on this land for thousands of years and thousands of generations, and it's where they belong. They don't belong being picked up and moved into another community. We've seen town camps have never worked in the past, and they'll never work in the future, because these people belong on the land where they come from.
Mm. Let's talk about Whitegate then. What's been happening there?
Look, I think Whitegate is a complicated situation in regards to, as I understand it, there's 17 town camps and this one hasn't signed a special purpose lease or something, and because they haven't signed the lease, they're not getting the water. So I think it's a little bit more complex than the Utopia situation. The Utopia situation was just the bore. A 20-year-old bore broke by the Shire, who were coming there to actually service it. And then they've been trucking water in since. People have got scabies because there's no water for sanitisation. But the town camp is a bit different. It's a bit closer to Alice Springs. So there's politics involved. And I'm not across.
And people are, caught up in this.
So I'm not totally across those politics in Alice Springs, which is why we sort of haven't got too involved in that one yet, whereas the Utopia one is a lot more clear cut. But, you know, they've got to be able to come around the table and talk about this. If people really want to stay on their homelands and if they are traditional owners of that land, there needs to be some way that maybe a mediator can be brought in or something for them to negotiate with the Shire.
Does it astound you that these, I mean, for you guys, these are clear human rights abuses happening right here in Australia? I mean, let's not even talk about the refugee situation. I mean, this is happening to our own people on their own country.
Well, when we heard about the water stuff, we did a bit of investigation on the international law surrounding water, and it's a heavily protected right, and it's the right to water and sanitisation. It's not enough just to have water to drink. You have to have water to wash yourself as well. So, you know, there's a lot of law around that. So those two situations need to be resolved quickly. And with regards to Umbulgari, I mean, I've been working in human rights for a long time, and it's the worst situation I've ever been involved in. It's just horrific because it's not just one thing. These people have been punished over and over and over again. And in regards to the community safety issues that came up in the inquest and the sexual assault task force, people have been charged and convicted and gone to jail for that. And in addition to
that, the rest of the community has been made to get punished for it.
So I thought that innocent until proven guilty was one of the fundamentals of our legal system. Does that not apply for Aboriginal people, for remote communities? If this was anywhere other than a very remote community, it wouldn't be allowed. And that community, there's three ways to get there. You can fly, takes about an hour. You can get on a boat, takes about an hour. Or in dry season only, you can drive 5 hours through gorges in an unsealed road to get there. I mean, why haven't they had a road? That community's been there since 1913 and they still haven't got a road that's passable in the wet season.
Yeah, if we talk about, you know, government's talking about dysfunctional communities, is that the only dysfunctional community in Australia? And, you know, what are they going to do to the other ones? And this is directly because it's an Aboriginal community. That's why they've done it. And that's how they've got away with it, because no one cared. And that's the reason.
Do you see this being replicated elsewhere, in South Australia?
In South Australia. Perhaps more so, again, in Western Australia, though. I think that the Western Australian government's attitude towards Aboriginal people is like that.
And the whole thing about hub towns and you know,
growth towns, that sort of stuff.
It's too expensive to have unviable communities. I mean, we have great technology. Umbulgari, for example, is run by diesel. It's right up in the middle of the Kimberley. Why haven't they got solar panels? You know, why aren't we doing sustainable ways that don't cost the earth endlessly for these communities to become viable?
Okay. What can people do, those listening to us right now?
Well, we'd love people to come go to the Amnesty International website and sign the action as a start. We've already had close to 19,000 people do that, but we need more. So that will send an email automatically to the Minister for Housing and the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs in Western Australia. We also have put a couple of Facebook posts up. We'd ask people to share that through social media. There's a number of media stories online. Share those. Get people talking about it. And the letters that we send, they're just like a standard one, but you can adapt that. Say whatever you want to government. Ask for a response. If there's anyone up in the Kimberley, I mean, I reckon, you know, go out there and let them know that the demolition company. The demolition company itself is, you know, do they have a reconciliation action plan? Do they know that they're going in to destroy people's houses? Yeah. So there is a lot of action, but if people have specific ideas and want to help us, please email us at Amnesty International.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, a Western Australian government making decisions in Perth to destroy a community, and that's what they've done. They've destroyed a community of people. You know, they've moved this lot of people from where they are into more harsher social circumstances than what they had.
Mm.
And I think that's very sad that these people, you know, they had the ability to, when they was out there, to catch their fish, to hunt their kangaroo and to hunt their turkey. You know, and people told us very fond stories about how they, you know, they ate a lot of their traditional food there. They're in Wyndham now eating fish and chips, you know, and that's what they're doing. They're turning these people from traditional people into fish and chip blackfellas. That's what they're doing.
Mm. The injunction, was there an injunction? Did you seek a legal recourse at all or
we're
not?
We're not able to.
You're not able to.
It has to be a complainant. It has to be the Ballingarra Aboriginal Corporation or a group of affected residents. Mm-hmm. We've certainly assisted them to work with some pro bono lawyers and that's underway, but it's quite a difficult process with all the authority to act, and they've had their big CALAC AGM last week, so they were all out. All the people who needed to be involved in this were out at Jalmadanga outside of Mobile Range.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, we hope that that's proceeding, but, you know, that's not up to us. What we can do, we're a campaign organisation, so that's why we're focused on getting this out into the media. Getting the action up. So, but if other people have other ideas, let us know. We're open to ideas.
Because the last story I saw about this in the West Australian was that these contractors were pretty much ready to move in. Are they there already?
They're there already.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're destroying they're probably destroying houses today.
As we speak.
As we speak.
We got photos on Monday of construction equipment there. We've got someone who's assisting us on the ground in Wyndham, and they went out on Monday.
Mm.
So it's already, and they were told to leave, but they got some photos before they left. So the construction equipment's already there.
Oh, you troublemakers, you.
Destruction equipment. For a government to say that we're destroying the houses so they're not vandalised, you know, what more than a 14-tonne excavator would vandalise a house?
And the other thing is that they're not even taking the rubbish away. They're digging a big hole.
They're burying it.
And they're going to bury it right there on that land. And, you know, some of those houses are asbestos and there's all sorts of issues. We don't know where the appropriate Aboriginal Heritage surveys were done.
Mm.
We know there's sacred sites there. There was a massacre there. There's a really important place right near the water tanks which are being destroyed.
Mm.
You know, so we haven't had any answers from government as to whether this occurred. We also know that there was a housing management agreement in place, and we believe that the Residential Tenancies Act was breached, but no response from the WA government other than to say through the media, not directly to us, but through the media, that we're ill-informed. Well, we went there and we sat down on the grass with those people and we took statements and we listened to them. We are more informed than they are.
Mm, mm. Tell us about some of the individual stories there. I mean, about that leader who sadly took his own life, but who were some of the people that you met?
Look, some of the people, some of the ones, it was the last 10 that sort of, and they're sort of like the, they're the leader group almost of those people that were still there. And, you know, a lot of those people wanted to go back and live there because they knew the life they was living in Wyndham was not a good life. They knew that the things, the social things that was happening, they was, you know, like Tammy was saying, they're stigmatised they're stigmatised by everyone in the town, by the police, by every other group. You know, oh, they're all Umbi people. And they was the sad stories, and people talked about going out hunting a turkey and feeding their kids the turkey, showing them what their tucker was, and telling the stories about the place. And all that is now gone, you know. And that's sad. Those people was very sad, and we had probably up to 50 people in a group there.
Yeah, I've got 25 signed contact forms, and we did about 10 proper interviews, which took a couple of hours each, but we didn't have a lot of time, so there was many people that waited for us, but everyone had so much to say.
Mm.
But the stories are tragic, you know, like one guy, David Ryder, used to run the power station. He now is living with his partner in her sister's house and doesn't have a job. You know, there's this man that committed suicide. There's this old lady, old Stella, she cries every day. You know, the elders are really upset about it. The young people are upset. Another family who stayed right until the end. In the end, the reason that he left was because they shut the water off and he had babies and he knew that they would take the babies.
Yeah.
You know, so there was all this forced coercion of people. That's why the International Secretariat have backed us to say publicly that this was a forced eviction.
Yeah. All right. And you can go to the website to find out more about that. And I think there is a form, a standard thing that you can fill out.
Yeah, and the Facebook page.
And the Facebook page. Okay. I have with me human rights campaigners Rodney Dillon and Tammy Solnick from Amnesty International. And they're in our neck of the woods for the next, well, how long have you been here?
3 days.
3 days? Okay. Yeah. And what have you been doing? Something to do with a youth justice campaign?
Yeah, we've been doing some work on trying to get around people and talk to them about the youth justice work that we're going to do up here, working with youth, looking at ways to stop the kids from going into the system in the first place,
yep.
And looking at what's going to stop the kids from going from juvenile custodian up to the big jail.
Mm.
So that's sort of and what's making the kids go in there in the first place. I think these are all the issues that we're looking at. You know, we just don't want governments to be building more and more jails and locking more of our kids up. We want, you know, remedies that's going to stop our kids from going into that system.
Mm-hmm. And, are you talking about the justice reinvestment, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that could be certainly part of what we're talking about, rather than spending the money on the people over a period of a lifetime and keeping them in jail, is looking at putting some money into the kids in the first place and stopping them from going into that system. And, you know, we've looked in different parts. We've been working in Western Australia, and we're, you know, going to come here and work in Queensland, and then Northern Territory, and then we're going to do an overview of the three states and have a look at that. But I think the important thing is to look at, you know, is there better diversionary programs that will work that'll stop the kids from, you know, and while the kids are in that system, looking at addressing the issues that they've got, so when they come out, that they're better citizens in the community.
They don't get back in re-offend. Trouble again.
I think that's probably one of the most important things we can do with all this, is to try and stop the kids from going into that system and becoming full-time people in that system. And that's what I'd like personally. That's what I want to stop, that system of all our people. I feel very sad as an Aboriginal person to be in the, whether it's Darwin or here, and see all our Aboriginal people going through and being locked up in that system forever. It just makes me feel sad that our people are they've been very good, you know, the government's been very good at locking people up. They even locked them up as soon as they got here, you know. So that system of locking people up doesn't always work. It's, you know, there is alternatives to doing that. And yes, we need to have a society that has law and order, but there's ways you can do law and order.
Yeah, yeah. What about in your own home state there? What's the situation there?
We've got kids locked up in every state, you know, and I think that Tasmania's not got as many at the moment, but, you know, we've had shock and problems with kids, you know, locked up in that system and have done for years.
Mm. Oh, well, Western Australia, I mean, we've had a recent death in custody there, and, I mean, it's almost a battle between those three sort of states, Queensland, Northern Territory and Queensland, about who can lock up the most blackfellas.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's why we've chosen those three jurisdictions, Western Australia, Queensland and Northern Territory. So we're doing a report focused on each of those jurisdictions, as well as a national overview. But the problems, I wish we could have covered every state and territory, because, you know, New South Wales has more Aboriginal people than anywhere else and has huge problems.
Not for long, I don't think.
Was it Queensland catching up?
Catching up, I think. I think the prediction is, what, by 2030, I think there'll be biggest mob living in Queensland.
Yeah, and South Australia, poor old South Australia gets forgotten a lot, I think, and Tasmania. But, you know, that those decisions were actually made before I came on board, and we're moving ahead with that. And it's huge already to do three jurisdictions plus a national overview.
Mm.
And we have to, the reports that we're doing are going through the International Secretariat, so they have to be at a very high level.
Mm-hmm.
So Western Australia report is first. We've finished our consultation and our primary research.
So who have you been consulting with community orgs? I mean, the corrections, police?
Police, magistrates, mm-hmm. Aboriginal Legal Services, Legal Aid, all the Department of Corrective Services. We weren't going to go to Child Protection, but everyone said we did, so we've gone to them as well. Anyone involved in a diversionary program, and in particular Aboriginal diversionary programs, and some medical professionals, because one of the focus areas we're looking at in WA is Fitzroy Crossing, and we're looking at Fitzroy because one in three children is born with some form of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
Yep.
And it's a lot of those kids. A lot of kids who end up in detention have some form of underlying medical condition. So we need to be able to treat those conditions rather than just punish them for something they were born with.
Okay. And are you worried that... I mean, is this kind of study being sort of attempted before? You're not going over, you know, old ground, if you know what
so,
I mean.
Yeah, so we were talking about this yesterday. This is an area that a lot of people doing work on. There's heaps been written.
Yeah.
So the first thing that we did, which was prior to me starting, was a literature review, desktop research, and we engaged some experts, Harry Blagg, Chris Kanine, and Melanie Schwartz, who and Chris and Melanie are experts in justice reinvestment.
Yeah.
So they did the desktop research for us. We already have that.
Yeah.
But Amnesty is very focused on primary research. So that's why we've gone out and done all those individual interviews, which are being transcribed, and one of our team members at the moment is writing that up. We're also working quite closely with the Justice Coalition to ensure that, and criminologists. Yeah. We've got a group of criminologists that are looking to ensure that the recommendations we come up with work in tandem with what everyone else is saying.
Mm.
And the difference between this and other reports is it's not just a report. At the same time as doing the research and the report, we're actually planning a campaign.
Yep.
How many times do we see a report that gets written and released and sits on a shelf and the recommendations don't go anywhere? So we want the recommendations that we come up with, which I think will duplicate many recommendations already set.
Mm.
We want to come up with a plan to make them happen.
Yeah, yeah. Something perhaps replicating something like Oxfam did with the Close the Gap.
Yeah.
And I think that some of the work, like what we're trying to do is as well as involve everyone in this, not leaving anyone out. We're looking at talking with the justice system, we're talking with the police, and we're talking with the Aboriginal families. And I think if we leave any one of those ones out of this system, everyone will blame the one that you leave out. So we're trying to involve everyone that's in it to have
a lot of stakeholders.
To have all the stakeholders to have a buy-in. Because, you know, a lot of the police want to help. You know, there's some good police boys clubs who have done some good work with Aboriginal kids and who are so there's lots of people in the system who are wanting to make change. They don't like locking these kids up either, and they want to see these kids, you know, they want to see these kids thrive in their community and be good citizens.
Mm.
And they, you know, some of the police that we've talked to have been really good about this, and some of the judges as well, you know, they've spoke, you know, really highly, and some of the people that they've worked with, they've been very proud of some of the people that they've actually turned around in this system. So there's lots of people in this system that want to work together make change.
So you've been talking specifically with people in the system, not necessarily the politicians?
No.
I guess because
they're the ones who will lobby once we start campaigning.
Yes.
But look, there are certain politicians who are very aware and engaged in this area that, you know, we work with, like Penny Wright from the Greens. She's the one who led the Senate inquiry into justice reinvestment.
Yep.
They've got some great stuff. There's in WA, we've got some great politicians as well that are working on this. So it's actually, it really surprises me. Everywhere we go, we're welcomed. Even from police and corrective services, people want to talk about this. People want solutions, not just Aboriginal people, white people too.
Mm.
So we all just have to work together. And lobbying politicians will be a big part of that.
All right. So Western Australia, Northern Territory is... Queensland's
next. Yeah.
And hence why you're here.
Yeah. Okay. So we've just done cultural competency training yesterday with all the Queensland staff, and we did a big workshop on...
Queensland staff, Amnesty.
Amnesty International, that once we start that campaigning on the ground, they have a degree of competency. We had Uncle Sam Watson come in and he talked to them about the local area and, just trying to get them engaged with the local community. So once we do start that campaign, they're competent to do so.
Mm.
So I'd just, like to say that if there's people out there that's working in areas who think that they've got information that will be good for us to use to get in contact with Amnesty International here or go to our website.
Yep. Okay. And when do you go to the Northern Territory and start that task there?
Well, the Western Australian report's been written now. Mm-hmm. We'll probably finish that towards the end of the year.
Yep.
So Queensland will sort of... Our consultation in Queensland will be early next year, and then probably mid next year will be Northern Territory.
Right.
So we hope that by the end of next year, We'll have all the campaigns fully operational.
Mm-hmm.
And when we launch the Western Australian campaign in about May next year, we'll also launch the National Overview.
Yep.
So the National Overview will have things like...
Is that happening right now type thing, or is it...
We've already got a lot of that together, and we've got the Justice Coalition. So there's lots of great stuff like, you know, getting justice targets in the Close the Gap framework, having a justice reinvestment framework. Funding is a huge issue. Funding for diversionary programs. Mm. There's a lot of discontent with Aboriginal organisations about faith-based organisations getting all the money for these things. That just takes us back to mission days, and it disempowers our organisations.
Yep.
So there'll be a lot of stuff about funding, and all that sort of high-level framework will come out of the National Overview, and then we'll dig down into the detail about like mandatory sentencing and policy and legislation and policing and on the state and territory level.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, that... We've seen in areas around Australia that when you've got Aboriginal people running these diversionary programs with culturally appropriate, they've worked very well, and the judges and the police and the prosecutors, everyone's been really happy with the turnaround in these kids in these systems. But we want, you know, and the faith-based ones that have been, you know, that are doing it, we want them to work with the Aboriginal community to change their view and to do it the culturally appropriate way with the Aboriginal people, you know, and to make that change is very significant and hard for some of those organisations to do. But we've seen that that's been a very successful way of doing it, where the other way that, you know, that it hasn't worked so well.
Yeah, we've been looking overseas too to our brothers and sisters over there, what they've been doing. They certainly had a lot more experience dealing with the white fella justice system.
Mm.
So you've been looking to Canada and United States?
America in particular. Mm. So 26 US states have officially adopted justice reinvestment.
Yeah.
And justice reinvestment is a framework, but the philosophy behind it is to put all the money at the beginning in prevention, diversion and early intervention rather than a band-aid at the end.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes people get scared of the term justice reinvestment because it's an upheaval of the justice system. But when we talk about it in these general terms of prevention rather than a band-aid, I think those sort of concepts can be taken all throughout the justice system and what we do. So, yeah, New Zealand is doing some great stuff. We're also looking at the UK. Mm-hmm. So we have a different legal system to most of Europe. They have a system, but we're looking mainly at the systems which come from England.
Yeah.
You know, anyone who's, Canada's very similar to us, and they're doing some great things there.
Mm, all right. Well, look, what's a phone number we can, you know, give out for Amnesty, or should we just...
Go to our website.
Just go to the website first and foremost.
Okay. Yeah, if you just put Amnesty International into Google, or we've got a Facebook page. I'm sorry, I don't know off by heart the number. I just email everything.
I'll have a quick look and I'll mention the phone number as well. So thank you both for coming in and having a yarn with us. And good luck with this particular campaign and the research that's going to go on in this state. And then
just to go on the... The three places that we're going to be looking at here in Queensland is Logan, Townsville and Palm Island, and the other place, it looks like it'll be Mount Isa as well. So they're the three main areas that we'll be doing work here in Queensland.
All right.
We're trying to get the spread of urban, regional and remote. And in WA it was Perth, Geraldton and the Fitzroy Valley.
Okay, yeah.
So they're the three areas that we'll be looking at. And we've spoke to a lot of people in Townsville, and we've been speaking to people in Logan, so these, and we haven't yet got to, and Mount Isa will be involved in one of our next trips. We think that area will be one. So if we've got people in any of those communities that want to talk to us, go to our website or our Facebook site. It'd be good to make contact with any of those people before we get there.
All right, and if you want to stop what's happening at Umbulgari as well, go to their website as well. But I'll find out those details for you, save you looking it up, and I'll give you the web address in just a moment. You're listening to 98.9 FM, National Indigenous Radio Service, and we're streaming live on the web. This is Let's Talk. And that number, by the way, for Amnesty International is 1-300-300-920. That's 1-300-300-920. Alternatively, if you want to read more about the work that they're doing in Indigenous Affairs, go to their website at amnesty.org.au, and you'll find an Indigenous rights section under our work. Otherwise, you can go right down to the bottom of the page and you'll see Indigenous rights right down there that you can click on to take you to that page, and it'll tell you all about Umbulgari as well in their campaign to stop the demolition of those houses from occurring. And that is Let's Talk for today and for this week. I'm Karen Durante. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.